Welcome to the NACE Clinical Highlights Show. This episode features Q&A with Dr. Greg Sherman, Chief Medical Officer with NACE, and Dr. Stoller, Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine at Northwestern University, from a recent NACE virtual symposium.
This topic, hypoglycemia and glucose variability, kind of frames the reason why we're talking about using insulin more effectively. And it has nothing to do with the fact that we now have more physiologic insulins available to us and concentrated insulins. It comes to the comes from the understanding that we were having much more hypoglycemia and much more glucose variability than we ever realized. When basal insulins came to market about 25 years ago, it was great. They were flat. They were easy. You could add insulin and not worry about it. And you could give more. And you could give more. And more. And nothing bad seemed to happen. In fact, sometimes glucose didn't even go down, but it was easy. And because it was flat and basal and easy, we simply put patients on the insulin and didn't really worry about glycemic variability. It wasn't a concept we knew anything about back then. Well, along comes continuous glucose monitoring, and there are many patients whose blood sugars are up and down all day long without even being aware of it. And that leads to increased risk for hypoglycemia, as well as complications from diabetes, which are magnified. So we'll start by discussing hypoglycemia and glucose variability. The worst part of having hypoglycemia is if you have it once, you're going to get it again. Because one single episode of hypoglycemia induces unawareness of hypoglycemia for future events. It does it on several levels. So number one, the counter-regulatory response to low glucose is reduced even after a single episode. So that if you have one episode of hypoglycemia from a shot of basal insulin, for example, the next time around, you may not appreciate it. And it's not necessarily going to happen at the same time of day. So maybe it happened at night the first time. It could happen the next day while you're out driving your car, and you won't feel it the same way as you would. Part of it is because the counter-regulatory response is altered after one episode. So whenever your blood sugar goes low, you make the hormone epinephrine, adrenaline, first, and then cortisol and growth hormone as a later response. Well, if the adrenaline response is blunted, you may not feel the hypoglycemia and therefore have hypoglycemic unawareness, which again creates more hypoglycemic unawareness. And that's why our old use of insulin was more problematic than we realized, and why some of the newer, more physiologic insulins may be important, but just using basal insulin more effectively is also important. And certainly in the elderly have reduced hypoglycemic awareness de novo. That's just part of getting old. And so they're at even greater risk for this issue. And nocturnal hypoglycemia, no one is waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning to check their blood sugars. And so it's often unrecognized. And the only way you as a clinician could ever know that a patient was having hypoglycemia is either a new diagnosis or new complaint of night sweats, or in a given week, they say, you know, one morning my blood sugar is fine, it's 68, and the next morning it's 205. What's going on? That's a patient who's having unrecognized nocturnal hypoglycemia.
Do you think there's any evidence that if we do a better job that we get that we get rid of the unawareness and we get the awareness back?
Doing a better job is patient-physician partnership. And if there's no symptoms, it's hard to do a better job. And we'll talk about strategies for monitoring and maybe reducing hypoglycemia just overall in a little bit.
Okay.
So there's a price to pay for hypoglycemia. In diabetes, if you're treating hypertension, you will not tolerate orthostatic hypotension. You change your therapy, you change drugs, you have zero tolerance. In diabetes, hypoglycemia is just felt to be the cost of doing business. But it's far more dangerous than even drops in blood pressure can be because of the effect on QT intervals. Because when you have an episode of hypoglycemia, not only do you get the adrenaline release, so vulnerable myocardium may be prone to arrhythmia, but you're prolonging the QT interval. It's associated with arrhythmias. It's associated with sudden death in a patient population that obviously is at risk from the very beginning. And in primary care, we have so many drugs that prolong the QT interval. Patient calls you, I've got this bronchitis, they get put on Zithromax. Boom, prolonged QT interval. Now I've got a vaginal infection. Boom, tablet of Diflucan. Now they're on a sulfonylurea or insulin and have a hypoglycemic episode on top of their Zithromax, fluconazole, and an antidepressant that also
perfect
does.
Perfect setup.
Perfect setup for an adverse event. And so really watching for hypoglycemia is so important because so many of our other drugs in primary care prolong QT interval in and of themselves.
Well, I've gotten some interesting questions. One of our colleagues, Nicole, asked an interesting question, and she says, can QT prolongation from hypoglycemia cause elevated troponin levels without an MI? Any insight into that?
No, because that's electrical, and troponins go up from plumbing. So you'll only get troponin elevation from ischemia. QT prolongation is strictly an electrical potential manifestation. So mm-hmm. you won't see troponins.
Okay. And other than what we're about to talk about, which is monitoring, any other sense of how we can recognize this variability in our patients that may not be aware if they have hypoglycemic unawareness? Is there anything else that we can do to clue us in?
Yeah, ask. You know, we've got so little time with our patients. And so if you're seeing glycemic variability, you've got to take a few minutes to just probe, okay, your blood sugar was low this morning. What did you do with your insulin this morning? Because they're not going to necessarily volunteer. You've got to probe a little bit to see if there's any patient-induced component. I think the clues about morning variability, so if you have a morning blood sugar in one patient that goes between 90 and 160, that's a patient who's probably just got dinner coverage issues. There's mm-hmm. some variability with how you're controlling their dinner glucose. If one morning they're 65 and the next morning they're 200, they're having overnight hypoglycemia. And the third is, we tend only to ask very quickly about hypoglycemia. Mm-hmm. Are you experiencing any low blood glucose? Hypoglycemia. And the patient goes, no, because for them, low right. is 60, 50. We don't really necessarily ask the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes spending a couple minutes just teasing that out in a patient where you're challenged with what's really going on mm-hmm. here will help a lot.
Right, and I'd certainly add that this can also occur on oral medications, not just with insulin. Certainly, if you're using sulfonylureas, you might expect this. What about other metformin, TZDs, or some of the newer medicines? Do you see with them as well?
You know, when you get right down to it, it's insulin and sulfonylureas that you need to worry about glycemic variability because those are really the drivers. You can see hypoglycemia with any agent mm-hmm. for type 2 diabetes, and especially in a patient you might have on three agents, mm-hmm. you might see some hypoglycemia. But the bottom line is those two classes of drugs, which we use a lot,
right.
are the drivers for variability.
All right.
And actually, that's an important point to stress. As we begin to talk about self-monitored blood glucose versus the continuous glucose monitor, your patients all see the advertisements on TV for the freestyle device where you don't have to stick your fingers, and they all want to go on it because mm-hmm. who wants to stick their fingers? But the bottom line is that continuous glucose monitoring is only a value for patients where you're making therapeutic adjustments based on what you're seeing. So if a patient's on metformin and an SGLT2 inhibitor, they don't need continuous glucose monitoring. Mm-hmm. Things aren't changing very much. You can get that data with self-monitored blood glucose. For patients who are on injectables and primarily insulin-based regimens, mm-hmm. those are the patients where you're going to want to look for glycemic variability because those are the patients who are going to make day-to-day, week-to-week mm-hmm. adjustments in therapy. A little note is that as you consider continuous glucose monitoring for patients, Medicare requires that you document and often prove that the patient is monitoring their blood sugar four times a day. So it's not a substitute for, especially the Medicare coverage population, to just say, well, if you don't want to stick your fingers anymore, here's this device. Mm-hmm. You've got to have proof that you're adherent with.
At least to get someone to pay for it. Are any of these billable if we started to do these in our practices?
Physicians can bill for outpatient diagnostic use of the mm-hmm. CGM. And so many physicians have integrated that into their practice just to be able to see, and especially for patients mm-hmm. who can't get coverage or afford continuous glucose monitoring, it's a way of at least seeing, well, what's going on at the current time.
And that's
time.
Equally applicable to nurse practitioners, physician assistants.
Oh, totally.
In fact, any provider.
I think it's even easier for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, because they have a little bit more face-to-face time with a patient that's not quite so distracted because there's so much data to mine from this that if you just take the time to look at it, like I said, you can see behavioral stuff. So, yeah, it's a tool that anybody can use mm-hmm. and I think is very effective for everybody in the audience.
Cool. So Romelia is out there and asked about beta blockers and hypoglycemia and how to address that risk.
So non-selective beta blockers can mask the adrenaline response to hypoglycemia, but will not mask the neuroglycopenic. Now, you wanna sense it before you get to that stage. So if you have to use a beta blocker in patients who are on insulin, use the lowest possible dose and tend to use a more cardioselective beta blocker mm-hmm. when you can.
Jose asked about exercise and glycemic variability, how that plays. If you're seeing this before you jump ship and switch therapies, should you give different exercise regimens or even acknowledge when the exercise is happening?
That's more of an issue in type 1s. Type 2s are so insulin resistant that the impact of individual episodes of exercise really doesn't impact glycemic control. So that's much more of a type 1 problem. And in a type 1, you would have them modify if they're on the pump. You have them do temporary basals. If they're not on the pump, you have to sit down and go, what time of day do you exercise? Try and get them to do it at the same time of day when they do exercise, and then give them parameters for how to modify their insulin dose before exercise. But in type 2s, that's rarely an issue.
Okay.
Patients who have severe insulin resistance often require large doses of insulin. Our pens only go up to certain amounts with our standard basal insulins. And so if you could concentrate it, that would help reduce the number of injections. But as we'll see, as you inject more and more insulin, it behaves less and less physiologically. It doesn't behave the way that you want it to with a bigger and bigger dose. And so if you can concentrate it, the injection is actually smaller and absorption is more predictable. And that's the rationale for concentrated insulins in patients who are on large doses of insulin. In patients who are on small doses of insulin, as we'll see, you can still use concentrated insulin, but it's only to reduce glycemic variability. So if a patient, for example, is on, say, 16 units of glargine U100, and they're having glycemic variability, you may not get any difference in control, but you may get less glycemic variability by putting them on the concentrated glargine U300 form, because it has less variability.
So we're not really talking about it, but a lot of us do it. They'll split the dose of an older basal insulin.
That's what these new, longer, newer basals, the concentrated glargine and then degludec, are designed to get past the old splitting the basal. Because you know what happens when you tell your patient to take an injection twice a day? Compliance, we know, with any BID medicine is lower than once daily medicine.
Right.
And so this gets past the old split dosing.
Mark, there's a bunch of questions that I think would be a good point to address. Fahid asked about postprandial readings. What do you think is an acceptable reading to feel like you've done a good job?
So I always choose a number that makes the patient feel they've done a good job. Because they always have to have some sense of success. Ideally, you want a two-hour postprandial below 140. That's ideal. I usually tell patients, if your postprandials are above 180, we've got an issue that we've got to work on. And I think if you just give them those two numbers and tell them to monitor for a week, the insight that they'll get out of it is, okay, this is what I had for dinner, and my two-hour postprandial was 198. This is what I had for dinner, and my two-hour postprandial was 135, I did good. So maybe I need to have more of this and less of that at dinner. So you can use it as a behavioral modification tool as well. But I think 140, 180 are good parameters, sort of A and C.
What about follow-on biosimilar insulins? It's the newest kid on the block. Any thoughts on what we should do with that?
So biosimilar insulins are biosimilar, meaning they are non-inferior. A1C reduction is the same. Cost is somewhat different, and so they may have a more favorable cost profile for patients, and that is a huge driver with basal insulins because our patients are so insulin resistant and are on large doses each day. And I think that's why we need to look at the dose we're giving. Is it really accomplishing what we want? Because it is costly to take 60 units a day of basal insulin that may not be giving you efficacy. But the biosimilars are a bit more cost-effective with same degree of glycemic control.
So what about NPH insulin? Now, some other comments.
If you got to do it, you got to do it. NPH is my friend when my patients are in the donut hole. There are certain brands that are $35 a vial. Other brands are not, but certain brands are $35 a vial. And if patients are willing to do that, you have to do it with the knowledge that they're going to have more risk of nocturnal hypoglycemia. And so the patient needs to be cautioned on that. Their control won't be as good because you're probably going to have to cut back the dose some. But yes, NPH is a very reasonable strategy. A1C is the same. If you chose sort of the Cadillac Degludec or twice daily NPH, the A1C is going to be the same. You're going to have way more hypoglycemia with the NPH than you will with the degludec.
Okay. Terrific.
You drive a cheap car, you're going to get in more accidents than when you drive an expensive car. That's kind of the analogy. NPH is fine, but you really have to be careful using it because of the hypoglycemia.
Right. So before I let you wrap up, another question from our audience about 70-30. We talked about NPH. Do you still use 70-30 for your uninsured patients?
You know, 70-30 is not incredibly inexpensive because the short-acting component is still there. Yes, I do. And you have to do what you have to do based on what a patient has access to. Know the day-to-day variability. So because patients don't eat the same things at the same time, you're going to have much more variability with the fixed-dose insulins. And so with that as a given, you have to be aware that sometimes they're taking their 70-30 at 8 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock at night. The next day it may be 6 in the morning and 8 o'clock at night. And NPH just has variability in its duration of action. So they're going to have a lot of glycemic variability. That's a patient where you're going to set a different glycemic target for. Because they can't increase the 70-30 for a meal because you're increasing the short-acting, but NPH downstream where the patient may not eat. So you have to accept a higher A1C target if you're going to use 70-30.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the NACE Clinical Highlight Show. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast and take a moment to visit naceonline.com to register for upcoming live CME and CE symposia and to take NACE on-demand CME and CE courses. Also, be sure to visit and like us on Facebook at NACE CME.